From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Today, I am joined by Rick Ellis, who is the co-author of the musical Jersey Boys, which will be playing in Columbus August 17th through September 5th. Welcome, Rick Ellis.
Hello, Doug. How are you?
I'm great. Tell me about the writing of this musical. How did you take the songs of Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons and make that into a musical?
There's a computer program that you buy called Plot Perfect. I think it's $18, and you put it into your computer, and a musical comes out. It's fantastic.
That's great. You know, I would have thought it would have been musical perfect for you instead of plot perfect.
Yeah, but, you know, it's always the plot. It always comes down to the plot, especially when, you know, we were blessed to have the music in advance. So that's a segue into your actual question, into a real answer for your question.
Okay, good.
Everybody knows the songs of the Four Seasons, even if they don't know that they're Four Seasons songs, which is exactly who I was when my phone rang and somebody said, would you like to do a musical about the Four Seasons? And these were all songs that I was familiar with, but as a kid. But at the time, I was too young to have control of the music in my home, and so these were songs that I learned in summer camp because they were the records that the counselors played. And so I thought they were really great songs, and I loved them because they were, you know, the songs that introduced me to rock and roll when I was a boy. But I wasn't necessarily aware that they were all Four Seasons songs. And when I met Bob Gaudio, the principal songwriter of the group, and Frankie Valli, the front man of the group, sort of the marquee name of the group, with Marshall Brickman, my writing partner, what we were amazed by was not just that they had all these amazing songs, and that the songs sort of grew in terms of how they are constructed, how sophisticated they are, how they're arranged on record, instruments that are used, instruments that aren't used, sound effects that are used. There were, you know, production techniques. They were all kind of, they gradually got more and more sophisticated, and because the group has had a long life, you actually see a growth of technique beyond just the songwriting itself in terms of the production of the records. But everybody knows their songs, and nobody knows their story, which is why Marshall and I looked at each other when we first met them and thought that we'd hit the mother load. Their story's never been told, and their story has it all, which is to say it's got love and hate and poverty and power and music and money and revenge and betrayal.
Which are all of the positive attributes you think of with the songs of the Four Seasons.
Well, exactly. You know, had any of their life stories come out in terms of publicity when their records were coming out, they would have been career enders. Because we expected, I guess, in the 60s, our groups to be squeaky clean, or at least to be exotic, like the British Invasion bands. You know, the Beatles had wonderful accents and great-looking hair, and they came from a faraway place, and these guys were just blue-collar high school dropouts from the wrong side of the river. And so nobody wrote about them, and if they had, you and I wouldn't be talking because there never would have been a show. But what the lives that they lived are almost Shakespearean, and the songs that they have are these American pop classics that don't seem to have any connection at all to the truth of what was happening to them while they were making these records. And that, of course, is, I think, what's so fascinating about the show and why the show has become so popular. Of course, there are wonderful, we call them the big three in the show, Sherry, Big Girls Don't Cry, and Walk Like a Man, because Bob Gaudio wrote three number one records in a row in 1962 and early 63, which is, you know, an impressive hat trick for anybody. He was 18 or 19 years old at the time.
Wow.
Which makes it even more impressive. But those songs fall in our show about 45 minutes in, because, of course, the group doesn't exist at the beginning of Jersey Boys, so they couldn't very well be singing the songs that made the Four Seasons famous at the beginning of the show. First, the band has to meet, and they have to figure out what they are going to do and who they are and what their sound is and what their identity is, and they go through a lot of stuff before they become the Four Seasons, and then finally they hit with Sherry, and it's kind of like pulling back a slingshot for 45 minutes as far as the audience is concerned. Of course, there's music in the show before in the first 45 minutes, but the first time we hear the famous Four Seasons sound in a major hit, is it comes with Sherry, and that slingshot is let go, and the audience responds the way an audience would have responded at American Bandstand in 1962, and it's really kind of thrilling. And then Big Girls happens immediately, and Walk Like a Man happens immediately after that, and it's almost like being at a concert. Des McAnuff, our director, made a really wonderful fundamental decision early on in our process, which was that the guys playing the Four Seasons, the actors would also be able to play their own instruments, and they would be and they would sing their own songs, and they would face the audience in front of microphones and perform these songs in a way that feels authentic to the way we remember the record sounding. So there's no jazzing up of the, there's no Broadway'd up music in this show. It is you're hearing something that sounds truly authentic, and the audience, as a result, responds the way an audience would have responded then, and it's kind of electrifying. It's a wonderful piece of alchemy in this particular show, and the credit for it goes to our director, Mr. McAnuff.
So then when you were writing it, you weren't really thinking of them as singing the songs in a Broadway style?
No, I wouldn't. We worked on this show. We wrote the show per se after the three of us, Des, Marshall, and I, had decided on what the structure of the show was going to be. The show is in four sections, and conveniently enough, the four sections are spring, summer, fall, and winter, because of course we're telling the story of the four seasons, and it's kind of nice and as a theatrical treat that there are that the nature's seasons follow the arc of the story of the band. Spring is the birth of the band. Summer is the full blossoming of the band's success, where these big three songs first appear. Fall is the falling apart of the group, the dissolution of the original quartet, and then winter is the winter of Frankie's discontent, as it were, where he's faced with how to move forward as an artist. Should he stay with the group? Should he become a solo artist? How is all of this affecting his family? How does he deal with the fact that people are leaving him professionally and personally in his life? So, and each of the seasons, each of the men playing the original quartet narrates one of those sections. So the audience gets to play along in a Rashomon kind of way. And we're always dealing with the essential conflict between what actually happened on the one hand and the way these guys describe what happened on the other. There's a line in the show, you ask four guys what happened, you get four different versions. And of course that's true, at least four different versions. So the audience gets to play along. It's interactive in that regard. But we always knew that the songs were going to work within the story and not the other way around. We didn't start with a song list on Jersey Boys. We started with the story. And because it's the story of four guys who made music, the songs naturally occur in a pretty chronological way as the story unfolds. But then in Act Two, the songs begin to be more cunningly selected and placed within the narrative of the story, so that they begin to comment ironically or emotionally on what's happening. And of course, one of the major events in Act Two is the struggle to over the release of the record that became Frankie's biggest selling record, and I think the number four all time recorded song in the American Songbook, which is "Can't Take My Eyes Off You," another really volcanic moment in the play, because when he finally comes forward to sing it, the title's never been mentioned, and the audience realizes that that's the song that we're talking about. It's more dramatically a demonstration of the friendship between Bob Gaudio and Frankie Valli, who at that time were no longer performing together. But musically, of course, it's one of the big highlights of the show in the second act.
You mentioned that you had met with Frankie Valli in some of the Four Seasons. How did this? Did this affect you as you were writing the play? Did you think that you were just going to represent each person to the way that they represented themselves to you, or you were going to represent them as you thought they should be represented?
Well, it's not a documentary. So we, as writers, we were always looking for places to make the story more involving, to make it more coherent, to make it more emotional, to make it more compelling, by combining certain characters, by changing some of the chronology, by telescoping certain events, the way writers do. We weren't just taking dictation from the guys and typing it up and putting it out in front of an audience. I don't think that you could do that and have a great show with a beginning, a middle, and an end. But we were for a while trying to conclude between ourselves, Marshall and me, how we would, who was actually telling the truth. And then our eureka moment was we were not going to decide for the audience who was telling the truth. We were going to let the audience decide for themselves. Now, three of the guys we spoke to, because they are still alive, the fourth original band member, Nick Massey, passed away before there was any movement on about this particular show, so we never got a chance to talk to him. And in real life, Nick Massey left the band inexplicably. After they had become hugely successful, he just walked away. And the other three guys never knew why. He never explained why. And they all have their theories. Well, each of the three of them have their theories about why he left. Their fans have their theories about why Nick Massey left. But as writers, we were able to do some detective work and do some creative work and to posit our own sense of what was going on in his head. And of course, that was another interesting challenge in writing the play. But the audience does get to hear four distinct points of view from these four guys. And when I was a kid, I remember the Beatles hitting, and girls in school would have buttons on their shirts and sweaters and things. I love Paul. I love Ringo. I love George. I love John. You know, it's like now with these movies, you know, these vampire movies that come out, you know, it's Team Edward or Team whatever the other guy is, our audiences at Jersey Boys take sides too in that same way. There are people, if most of the people see Frankie as the hero of the story, and certainly he is the hero of our story. He's a, you know, he's kind of an American success story in a thrilling way, a guy who really for no good reason managed to become a very distinct and unique recording artist. But the villain, this sort of the Shakespearean villain of the story, one of the other guys, because he's a rogue and a louse, and clearly a dangerous guy, he's very attractive to certain people, because that's the kind of character that attracts certain kinds of people. You know, the kind of guy you'd bring home if you were a girl that your parents would never approve of.
Okay.
And would hope that you'd break up with right away. So there are some people who really respond to that kind of a guy. The Bob Gaudio character, he's younger and he's somewhat more sophisticated, certainly more educated, musically more educated and with that spark of genius, the genius of being able to write these hooky songs and, you know, that take 2.5 minutes to play. And he's much more sensible and a loyal friend, and there are people who respond to that. And Nick Massey, the one who passed away that we never got to speak to, is the Ringo of this particular quartet. He's the one who's he's the fourth one that people think of, and he gets to express what that feels like to an audience. And there are always Ringos in the audience, because I think, you know what, I'll tell you something, Doug. I just had a thought, and it seems to me that it's kind of a big thought. And let me see if I can figure out how to say it in a way that's not it doesn't sound stupid. But it seems to me that I just said there are always Ringos in the audience, and I think maybe that's the universality that Jersey Boys has, that everybody who sees the show at one time or another has been part of a group. Now, I don't mean obviously that it's a that everybody's been in a rock band, but everybody's been in some form of a group, a bowl team or a bowling league or a cheerleading squad or an investment consortium or, you know, a secretarial pool or a carpool. We've all been part of a group. So while our story tells the story of this particular band, the Four Seasons, it's hard not to relate to that group dynamic. They're a very particular kind of family, but we recognize them, you know, because these groups tend to be second families, and they become dysfunctional, and they become maybe stronger than the bonds we have with our real families, and they deal with those issues that all families deal with, like wanting to be respected or wanting to find home, wanting to achieve, wanting to belong. I am nothing like the guys up there, but I recognize what happens to them because I've been through my version of what happens to them. I think that's what I mean by there are lots of Ringos in the audience, but there are lots of each of them in the audience.
So were you the Ringo in your story or which one?
No, let's see. That's a good question. I was the Bob. I was the one who was very work-oriented, the one who was, very conscientious about making sure that everything was done on time and everything was delivered properly. And, the genius part, I don't claim to be a genius. I'm quite certain that I'm not one. I think I'm a good craftsman. Marshall Brickman, of course, has a genius resume. So I'm happy to put that mantle of genius on him and on Dez. But I think everybody plays their role, and the role that I played was important to pushing the thing forward.
You're listening to Writer's Talk from The Ohio State University with my guest, Rick Ellis, co-author of the musical Jersey Boys, playing in Columbus August 17th through September 4th. For more about our guests, visit www.writerstalk.org. And now, back to my talk with Rick Ellis. What has been the reaction from Frankie Valli and the remaining Four Seasons to their portrayals in Jersey Boys?
Well, I remember very vividly the first time Bob and Frankie came to see the play. We were trying the show out in La Jolla, California, where Des McAnuff was the artistic director at the time. And that was the first place where we did the show. And we had about a week and a half of previews before we opened. And about a week into that preview period, Bob and Frankie and Bob's wife came to see the play together. And we stood in the back and watched them watch the show. And it was wonderful wonderful for all of us that they got to see it with an audience that was going crazy, because I think it was influential in terms of their reaction. If they'd watched it in a rehearsal room where they were the only three people who were the audience, their feelings about the show might have been different, but they were swept along in the energy and the incredible rocket ride that the audience goes on in the course of the show, like everybody else, and they responded like everybody else. Then, of course, over time, what happened is exactly what you described, including Tommy DeVito, who came and saw the show much later. What they say now is, I wish there was a little bit more of that, or I wish that, I was represented in this way, or, that's not really the way that it happened, or, maybe that. But generally, the success of the show has trumped their individual objections, and they don't want to sort of mess with success, I guess. But they certainly do feel, as their characters claim in the show, they feel as though their version of the way things happen is the true version, and they want that stamp of approval from the show. But the show doesn't give it. The show gives the stamp of approval to the overall experience, which feels somehow more honest. It seems to me that, something that bears repeating, and I should make a point of repeating it, is that it's very brave, I think, what these guys did, which is to say, go ahead, put it all up there, warts and all. Yes, of course they come, and we see them, we socialize with them, we see them at the theater, we go to auditions still, and they talk to us about their reaction to the show still. But the fact is, at the beginning of the process, they said, go ahead and do this. And it takes a lot of courage to do that. And somehow I think that becomes part of the audience's takeaway too, that this isn't a prettied up, airbrushed, puff piece of a show. You know, you see people with all their flaws.
It seems to me that as the writer, you would feel the natural inclination to treat the people well, since you know them, you've, as you said, socialized with them, even the one guy who was the louse or the lout, I can't remember.
It, your choice.
Right. But there's got to be that part of you as a writer who thinks that you, of the other person that's involved in this. And, you know, for my case, I might lose some sleep over how I would portray some of these real living people as characters.
It's interesting. I don't remember losing sleep. I think we tried to be really fair to all four of the guys, and sometimes it got us in trouble with Bob and Frankie, who of course had a approval of the script and read it before we ever went into rehearsal and said okay, but sometimes they would say no, that's not the way that's not the way it should be represented, this event, or this guy is looking too good and it's not fair to me. And it was an interesting tightrope for us to walk, because we tried to be fair to everybody and represent all four sides. I think if it was a challenge to be fair, and I don't know that we were fair, but we aimed to be fair. We aspired to fairness. I don't remember losing any sleep, because I remember aspiring to fairness. And I think that generally, certainly, you know, there's many audiences have come and reinforced this sense of that I have, that that we succeeded in at least not being unfair. If we weren't completely fair to people, it's because there's no way to do that in 2.5 hours. You know, the show would be much, much longer and perhaps much less interesting if we decided to represent everybody equally. And sometimes fairness is not just an issue of content, but an issue of quantity. So there are people, there are amongst the four of them, a couple who have less to do, and they may appear to be less important to the success of the group, therefore. But that's a conclusion someone can draw, but it's not one that we drew. I think if you're telling a story on stage, you need to have a couple of elements. You need to have conflict. You need to have strong characters. And so we, of course, spend more stage time with the conflict and the compelling characters than we do with the periods of time when everything was great and wonderful and everyone was happy, because it's just not that interesting to watch from a distance people being happy.
Right.
In the theater.
You've got to have some misery in the theater.
Well, you know, I'm not making this up. I mean, this was decided for us thousands of years ago by, you know, by Sophocles and Euripides and those other Greek guys,
right, yeah,
who said, you know, you've got to have conflict. Conflict is what keeps people leaning forward. And of course, some of the conflict in our show is, are they going to be able to come up with the music? And the music is the other thing that gets the audience leaning forward.
You mentioned earlier that you had built the songs into the show in a fairly chronological order. I'm wondering whether there's a song that for you really encapsulates everything that you felt was going on with the group at the time, something that really impressed you with the way that it told their story.
I'm not the writer, I think, you know, if you ask the writer, he'd say, well, it's like being a parent, you know, when you never have a favorite child, you love all your children equally.
Right.
But I didn't write them, so I do have a favorite, and it's Can't Take My Eyes Off You.
Pardon the way that I stare.
And the reason it's my favorite is because I think it's the reason that we have the show. When I was in graduate school, a movie came out called The Deer Hunter. I was working 6 nights a week and going to school during the day, and I had one night off. One night I went to see The Deer Hunter. It blew my mind. I got sort of hooked on the movie. Big, long, operatic film with a bunch of amazing actors in it. And I went several Monday nights in a row because it was my night off, and that's what I did for like a month. I went to see The Deer Hunter four Mondays in a row because I just thought it was amazing. There was a scene in The Deer Hunter which is about a group of friends just before they ship out to Vietnam and their experience after they come home from Vietnam. They are from a steel town in Pennsylvania, and they're real blue-collar guys. The night before they ship out, they meet at the local bar, which has a pool table, and they're all shooting pool, and somebody puts a nickel into the jukebox, and up comes the recording of Frankie Valli singing "Can't Take My Eyes Off You." There is the verse to "Can't Take My Eyes Off You," and then the chorus, and what separates, or actually what joins the verse and the chorus, is a Stan Kenton-y horn section vamp that is instantly identifiable and very, very famous, and it takes you into the chorus of the song. And when this Stan Kenton-y horn vamp started playing, everybody in this bar started singing along with the horns, and then when Frankie hits into the chorus, they all started singing along with Frankie in the chorus. And I remembered this moment from this movie as one of the real powerful, singular moments in this film. And years and years and years later, that was 1979, I think, and here we are in, 2004, writing the show. And before we write it, I go to Marshall and say, "You want to write a show about Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons?" And he listens to these songs like "Sherry" and "Big Girl," which are barbershop chords, really, that are very, very hooky. And, they're very cunningly arranged and obviously huge, successful records, but musically not particularly sophisticated.
Right.
And Marshall's a little bit of a music snob. And he said, "This is like pop stuff. This is bubblegum." And I said, "Okay, listen to this song." And then I stopped the CD. I said, "You know what? Don't listen to this song. Instead, I want you to hear this song while you're watching the scene in The Deer Hunter." And Marshall's a movie guy, so of course he was familiar with The Deer Hunter. And we listened to this song as he's watching this scene, and I said, "Look, there it is. There's the effect that this music had on the fans of the records." And we started talking, and we realized that the fans of the Four Seasons were not at all like the fans of the Beatles, for example, or, any of those other groups that were contemporaneous, because the Beatles songs were songs about love written for girls, and the Seasons songs were songs about girls written for guys. The principal fans of the Four Seasons were the guys who looked just like the guys who were up on the bandstand singing the songs. And that became a really important moment for us of understanding the impact that the music had. And when the show builds to "Can't Take My Eyes Off You" in Jersey Boys, I remember that moment. And for me, that's a supremely powerful moment. And in fact, when the horn section enters, the audience usually starts to applaud in the middle, right in the middle of the song. And that rarely happens in the theater, because the audience is paying attention to the story. And here, because they're paying attention to the story, they applaud that moment in the song, because it's set up for them as a story point, the actual horn section. At the end of the second act, the Bob Gaudio character says, he's describing the odd and extraordinary occurrence that the Beatles had number 1, 3, 4, and 5 on the charts, and the Four Seasons had the number 2 song, which was "Dawn." And so they were sort of fighting their own American Revolution against this British invasion. And the character says, "We were in a social movement like the Beatles." He says, "Our fans were the guys who were flipping burgers and pumping gas. The girl behind the counter at the diner with circles under her eyes. They were the ones who got us. Our fans didn't get on buses and protest the war. Our fans actually shipped out and went to fight." And as a overeducated, overprivileged, overanalyzed Upper West Side New Yorkers, Marshall and I had always taken for granted some sense of inborn superiority. And suddenly we thought very differently about the people across the river. And Doug, I'm telling you, when you sit in the audience or you stand behind the audience watching the show, you will see men like the guys who are in the group, and they're 55 now or 60 years old, and they hear that speech, and you can see heads nodding.
I greatly appreciate, Rick Ellis, your time talking to us about the musical Jersey Boys.
Well, thanks, Doug. I hope everybody comes. I think everyone will be glad they did.
You've been listening to Writer's Talk from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University with my guest, Rick Ellis, co-author of the musical Jersey Boys, which is playing in Columbus August 17th through September 4th. For more about our guests, visit www.writerstalk.org. Writer's Talk is a co-production of the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University and The Ohio Channel, where you can watch some of our interviews either at www.ohiochannel.org or by checking television listings for broadcast times. For signed books and interview DVDs of select Writers Talk guests, visit the Writers Talk section of the Ohio State University bookstore. Join us next week as OSU student Molly Patterson interviews Eric Olson, co-editor of We Wanted to Be Writers, Love, Life, and Literature at the Iowa Writers Workshop. Until then, this is Doug Dangler from The Ohio State University. Keep writing.